And France recently reported that childhood obesity rates are leveling off after rising for two decades. It's the first European country to show that kind of a shift. The French findings come from two studies of school-aged children, and the report suggests that healthier school lunch programs and a ban on vending machines in schools could be paying off. Eleanor Beardsley visited one French high school, a public school, with a dedicated professional chef.
Dominique Valadier starts his day at 5:30 a.m., just as the fish market opens in the southern French provincial town of Salon-de-Provence. Today, Valadier picks up 20 pounds of fresh live mussels before heading off to the Lamperie High School, where he is the cook.
Ciao, ciao.
After their morning greeting and a few laughs, Valadier and his staff of four get going on the day's meal for about 800 students. On the menu today, mussels in cream sauce over rice with leeks and stuffed turkey thighs accompanied by a squash au gratin casserole. Nothing here is frozen or pre-prepared, says Valadier, hoisting a sack of the algae-covered mussels.
Voilà. Alors là, on a une étiquette.
Voila! This sticker here shows where these mussels came from and when they were harvested. This guarantees their freshness.
Eyes twinkling and knives flashing, Valadier opens up the plump turkey thighs, cutting out the bones. He says you should be able to hear good cooking. The flattened turkey fillets are wrapped around a stuffing of ground-up parsley, garlic, cheese, and smoked pork shoulder. The loaves are then tied with twine and baked for 3 hours at low temperatures to keep in the juices and flavor. When sliced, they will serve hundreds of students, 10 times the number that could have been fed on the plain turkey thighs. Preparation and proximity are the keys to high-quality meals at lower prices, says Valadier.
On essaye de faire en sorte...
We try to get our base products, meat, fish, vegetables, within a 30-mile radius because there are fewer intermediaries and we can negotiate price and quality with the producer. These turkeys were raised and slaughtered just near here. If I have a problem, I'll ask the producer to come see me and I can guarantee you things will be a lot better the next time.
All around the school kitchen, pots and pans are cooking and simmering away. Gallons of bechamel sauce bubble for the squash casserole. A vat of chickpeas boils for homemade hummus. It's hard to believe this is a school cafeteria and not a 3-star restaurant. Perhaps what's most impressive about Valadier's meals is that they cost students only $3 a day, less than the typical fast food fare served at many French high schools. Another way Valadier saves money is by getting maximum use out of every ingredient. He never throws anything away. In one corner of the kitchen, he is boiling down the fish heads, flesh, and bones from yesterday's salmon to make a tasty bouillon for today's mussels. As lunch hour begins and the students file in, Valadier joyfully serves them while answering questions about the meal. He reaches across the counter with a forkful of the squash au gratin to give 17-year-old Valentine Biemans a taste. Biemans says she and her friends have all but quit eating lunch at McDonald's and have discovered a lot of new dishes.
It's all the time different food and it's very, very good. People are really happy because it's really hard now to eat well and cheap.
Valadier left the world of glamorous Riviera restaurants for something more meaningful. He's clearly found his calling here. Danielle Vieux teaches drama and English at the high school.
We are very, very lucky because it's a real project. It's not just doing the cooking. It's a whole concept of educating and doing something good and taking time and enjoying it. And it's artistic at the same time.
Valadier says investing in the students' well-being is also an act of citizenship. If young people learn to eat well early on, he says, it will cost the country's healthcare system a lot less in the future. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Salon de Provence.
There was a time in America when Shakespeare ignited great passion and once a riot. Today we embark on a summer Shakespeare series exploring where a fascination with the bard can lead. We begin with the story of two 19th century actors who conducted a famous feud over their rival renditions of Hamlet. The legendary British thespian, William Macready, was the darling of New York high society. The American star, Edwin Forrest, was the hero of the working class and the gangs of New York. In his book, The Shakespeare Riots, author Nigel Cliff tells us how the two camps clashed one deadly night in 1849. It all began decades before, when the plays of Shakespeare spread across what was then the rough frontier of early America.
You had Shakespeare popping up in the most extraordinary places. People would pay a chicken or a side of bacon to go and see his play being performed on what was essentially one of the boats moving down the Mississippi, and they would put a little shack on the back of it, put a gangplank to whatever town they or little hamlet they moored up at, and these little rudimentary creaking boats would be crammed every night with people coming to watch Hamlet or Macbeth or King Lear.
Yeah, it would run up a little flag that said, theatre.
Because it was the only one. They didn't need a name for it. And right through the frontier, as the frontier spread, the actors were really at the forefront, going out, finding the audiences. Even in the 1815s, you find family troops, at that point most of them still English, right in the heart of Kentucky, trekking through the wilderness to get to the furthest outpost where they would put on Shakespeare plays.
Now, I think a lot of people might be quite astonished today, given that Shakespeare is generally thought of as refined, lofty, and often expensive, to know that back in the middle 1800s, he was viewed as a people's writer.
I think that's right. I think it's partly to do with the way the theatre worked at the time. There was no real idea of culture on the one hand and popular entertainment on the other. It was all mixed together every night.
Let's go to New York and talk about what led up to the riots there. Now, the spark for this riot was a competition between the two foremost Shakespearean actors, one British, one American.
And these were the two greatest in the English-speaking world. Macready had worked his way up through the provinces and through some very painful periods competing for the limelight in London. Forrest burst out from nowhere as a teenager as the first great American star with an unruly and unschooled but incredibly powerful talent for seizing the stage. And so these two not only became representatives of their countries but also of the differences between their nations. Macready, the classically educated intellectual who was trying to make the theatre a respectable business, and Forrest the entertainer, who loved nothing more than hot-dogging across the stage with his polished muscles and his biceps gleaming and throwing on a great, great big show. So these two great actors, at the forefront of their countries, started out as friends, but such was the pressure in the business, the egos were so huge, that eventually they fell out. And this feud assumed the ridiculous dimensions of a minor international scandal. At the time, politicians never really travelled between the two countries, so these actors really were by far the most famous people who would appear in each other's countries. And then into the midst of this, you have this personal feud, which centres on which of these two great actors is showing the way forward for America, whether the upper classes who supported Macready, the elite, were going to set the tone for the future of the city, or whether it was going to be the working classes who supported Forrest.
Set the scene for us on the night of the riot. Who was there? What was happening?
Well, throughout the day, there had been posters going up over the city, encouraging the gangs of young men down on the Bowery to come and fight on behalf of Forrest, the American actor. At the same time, the upper classes had forced the mayor to call up the troops and ready the troops to take action that night as well. So you had thousands of gang members massing on the Bowery, hundreds of troops massing, and in the middle of it, this theatre. And by about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the evening, the mayor and police saw this horrific vision of New York being ruled by a mob. So very quickly, the order to fire was given, and the soldiers fired point blank into a mostly civilian crowd, really for the first time in American history.
How many people killed?
I think 25 that night, we know for sure. Dozens of people injured, all because two Shakespearean actors had disagreed originally over one line from Hamlet.
What was the line?
And the line was, "I shall be idle," which could either mean pretending to be mad or hanging back and not being noticed, which sounds very banal but goes to the crux of who Hamlet is at that point and to how MacReady and Forrest portrayed him. MacReady at that point did a little hopping jig around the stage with a handkerchief, obviously trying to look as if he was a bit balmy. And Forrest stood there and glowered in a very sort of macho way in the background.
Looking back, what would you say, that this was in some sense a low point, but also in terms of Shakespeare, a pinnacle in the sense that he never would matter so much to so many Americans again?
In some ways, yeah. I think the riot had the effect which was desired by the upper classes of removing serious drama from the working class theatres. Never again would respectable actors go step in these theatres where they could run into such behaviour. And I think by the time you reach that, it sucked all of the lifeblood out of Shakespeare. It sucked all of the popular excitement and enjoyment of his plays as everyday entertainment. And you go into the realm of academic Shakespeare, taught as a puzzle in schools rather than someone whose speeches would be on everybody's tongues. Shakespeare certainly was never at the heart of America in quite the way he had been before.
That was Nigel Cliff, who wrote the book The Shakespeare Riots. We expect to set off a riot of our own as we dare to ask, did the man from Stratford really write the plays? And if he didn't, what would motivate a brilliant writer to use the pen name Shakespeare?
If Shakespeare, whoever he was, had put his own name to the works, he wouldn't have survived 10 minutes because of the satirical and political content of the plays. He needed to mask that in some way, whether through a pen name or through a pen name and a front man, which is clearly what he used, the Stratford man as a front.
Groundlings, get ready with your tomatoes. Over the next 2 days, we'll take up what's known in Shakespeare circles as the authorship question.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. American newspapers are dealing with dwindling revenues by sending work overseas. And the headline on that otherwise common practice, the jobs going overseas aren't just answering calls. Those jobs include ad production, editing, and even a bit of writing. The venerable newspaper group McClatchy announced it's cutting 10% of its workforce, and while the company won't say how many of those jobs will be outsourced, some McClatchy papers are already sending work to India. But it's not just McClatchy newspapers. Major dailies like the San Jose Mercury News, the Tampa Tribune, and the Minneapolis Star Tribune are outsourcing jobs, and when they do, they turn to companies like Express KCS. The CEO of that company is Robert Barkley. Hello. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
Now, I understand that you have about 450 employees in your office outside New Delhi, and you call them operators. It's a term often used to describe call center workers. But are they educated? Do they have a journalism background?
No, in fact, most of these 450 that you're talking about are people who are really working on the design and creative side for newspapers, producing designs for advertisements. This is a job that for over 150, 200 years has been done in-house, but in fact now can be done by companies such as our own offshore in India.
Now, if someone's creating an ad in New Delhi for a paper local to, say, the Miami Herald, and I know you have a contract with the Miami Herald, does it matter that they will never have seen Miami?
No, it's really not an issue for us. It's about training and the transition process. So we can spend 4 to 6 months training our staff to understand the local and cultural norms that not only include the way an ad should look, but also include things like what's a leprechaun and what colours do we use on Valentine's Day. These are all things that need to be taught.
How much, besides advertising and other areas of copywriting, how much are you outsourcing writing?
We are doing a degree of that. We have magazine clients in the UK, for example, for whom we do that. We have newspapers in North America that are trialing that.
You know, though I wonder if you think there are limits on that. For instance, last year, a news website, PasadenaNow.com, came under a fair amount of ridicule when it hired Indian reporters in India to cover government meetings in Pasadena.
I'm aware that they came in for quite a lot of flack, which I think was very unfortunate. What James McPherson was trying to do...
And James McPherson, CEO of Pasadena Now.
Yes. What James McPherson was trying to do there was, in Pasadena, provide all-round coverage of what's going on in Pasadena, which included things that he simply couldn't have afforded to cover before. By reaching out to India, and I think he did this via Craigslist, he was actually able to bring something to his readers that he simply could not have done before.
Well, where do you see that trend going?
You're not talking about outsourcing things like photography, opinion, insight, perspective, creation of copy that needs people walking around City Hall, that needs people on the streets. But the distance between where they are and writing that copy and the reader receiving that copy and reading the story could happen anywhere in this electronic age.
Now, newspaper employees in different cities and areas around America, probably like any other kind of worker, won't be looking terribly kindly on the trend of outsourcing work to India. No. But presumably you think it's a good thing for the U.S. newspaper industry as a whole.
It's no secret that American newspapers are suffering from the double whammy of a downturn generally in the economy and a change in the mix of advertising. To look at it bluntly, as one of my guys in India said recently, if newspapers don't cut staff, they will lose all their staff.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Renee, thank you very much for your time.
Robert Barkley is CEO of Express KCS. And that's a company that outsources newspaper work to India.
We're visiting national parks across the country this week. And today we're heading a few hours outside Salt Lake City, Utah, to a site where dinosaurs used to roam. Like most parks, Dinosaur National Monument has a junior ranger program. Kids fill out a booklet, pledge to take care of the park, and get a little badge. But as NPR's Jeff Brady found, this park also enlists junior paleontologists.
Who would have guessed that millions of years ago, northeastern Utah was a hot spot for dinosaurs? And now, families like the Hazelwoods from Lexington, Kentucky, come to see the leftover bones. 10-year-old Justin Hazelwood is the family expert and an aspiring paleontologist.
Paleontologists study, like, what kind of fossils and what they used to live there. They, like, try to find new bones.
His mom, Kay Hazelwood, says Justin's obsession has become a family learning experience.
I didn't know anything about dinosaurs until he got interested in them when he was, like, 3. And we used to read dinosaur information books at bedtime. And my mom refused to read them because she couldn't pronounce the names. And she's like, I'm not reading those.
Justin's about to become an official junior paleontologist. There's an impressive gold star badge to be earned, but only after he completes a few tasks. First, there's an activity booklet. He's on page 3, picking out and circling the dinosaurs on a page filled with all kinds of animals.
The ones that flew, swam in water, and that are mammals are not dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were all reptiles.
Justin has inspired me to learn more, too, and maybe even earn one of those cool badges.
This one is a dinosaur?
A stegosaurus. Yeah.
Okay, that one's a horse.
Yeah.
That one?
That one's not, because it goes into water.
Oh, okay.
That's an early crocodile, but it was not considered in the dinosaur time.
The activity booklet is relatively new. Carla Beasley with the Park Service says the goal is to teach the 2,000 or so kids who come through each summer that fossils tell a story about the past and that you shouldn't stick them in your pocket.
We want them to keep the fossils that they find, like out on the trail or something, in place because a paleontologist can come and learn a lot more about that fossil by knowing where it is, not just what it is.
In addition to the booklet, there's a short hike.
Welcome, everyone. My name's Ranger Matt. I'm going to be your guide for the tour this morning.
After a short bus ride, Matt Groyal leads us up a steep trail along a rock face.
You know, because we came just from coming down the steps there, when we turned down here, we went about 20 million years.
Out on the walk, we run into another dinosaur fan, Tyler Sachs from Jupiter, Florida, and he's just spotted something interesting sticking out of the rock.
My sisters think it looks like wood, but I sort of think that it looks like bone. And I looked at it like this, and I see very, very small holes in it.
And what does that tell you?
Well, I know that some bones have holes in them, so it can, like, make blood and stuff.
For those of us with less trained eyes, there are white arrows pointing to some of the fossils. But figuring out what part of the dinosaur they were isn't easy.
It looks probably like some sort of leg or our arm piece or something like that.
As our walk ends, Justin Hazelwood and the other soon-to-be junior paleontologist get an encouraging word from Ranger Matt.
And you guys were doing just a fantastic job of finding your fossils. You are excellent paleontologists.
And then it's back to the visitor center to pick up our hard-earned badges, but only after raising our right hands and taking the junior paleontologist pledge.
I.
Your name.
Your name.
Your name.
Promise to take care of the fossils.
Promise to take care of the fossils.
And learn about...
Jeff Brady, NPR News, at Dinosaur National Monument near Vernal, Utah.
I promise to take care
of where I live, too.
Of where I live, too.
Congratulations.
Congratulations, Jeff, and you can see his impressive Gold Star Junior Paleontologist badge and activity book at npr.org.
Today we begin examining how some European nations provide nearly universal health care to their citizens. Each country has a different approach, but all spend less per person than we do in the U.S., where 47 million Americans have no health care coverage. We start in Germany. It has the world's oldest health care system and one of its most successful. Virtually all Germans have ready access to doctors, cheap drugs, high-tech medicine, even dental care. And Germany spends half of what the U.S. does per person. How do they do it? One way is by putting doctors on a budget, as NPR's Richard Knox reports now from Germany.
This isn't your generic, bland doctor's office. It's all designer furniture and bright splashes of color.
Hello, guten Tag. Come on, Leibel's my
name. Dr. Christoph Leibel is a dark-haired guy with a runner's build. His first appointment this afternoon is with Hugo and Inga Follertsen. Inga's 80. She says she has a problem with her ears.
The ringing is pretty obnoxious, and they suffer a lot, and quite often drives the people nuts. Problem is, there's nothing you can do about it, really.
Leibel examines Inga, discusses whether acupuncture might help, writes a prescription for her high blood pressure. The Follertsens leave his office very satisfied. Like most Germans, the Follertsens are very happy with their medical care. They say they get everything they need, no complaints. Leibel says they didn't have to wait long when Hugo had to have a heart bypass and Inga needed a knee replaced.
The system is really good. As far as the medical treatment and stuff is concerned, in my opinion, it's very good.
But Leibel's at his wit's end with this great system.
I don't get paid at the moment. I haven't been paid for what I'm doing for the last 2-3 weeks.
That's because it's the end of the quarter. Leibel, like most German GPs, has already used up his budget. Every quarter, doctors all over Germany are allocated a certain pot of money. Once that's used up, that's it.
I feel abused. Exploited in a way. Yeah, because, I mean, the work we are doing is pretty demanding, and I have a lot of responsibilities, and I think that should reflect in what I get paid.
It's not that German doctors live in poverty. The average German primary care doctor makes around $123,000 a year before taxes. That's about one-third less than the American average. This is one way Germany keeps health costs down.
I think the biggest difference between the U.S. system and the German system is that everything is cheaper.
That's Karl Lauterbach, a doctor himself and a member of the Bundestag, the German parliament. When he says everything is cheaper here, he means hospital care, prescription drugs, MRI scans, heart bypass operations, and administrative costs are almost 50% lower. But the biggest reason German health costs are so much lower is that doctors here are paid less. Dr. Heinz-Harald Upholt says he earned a lot more 20 years ago.
I get a third of the money I earned in the middle of the 80s.
Upholt is an expert on general practice at the University of Düsseldorf. He understands why German doctors miss the good old days, but he says they still do okay.
German doctors are the best-owning professional group in Germany.
More than lawyers, he says, more than architects or engineers. And not all doctors are unhappy with the system.
3 p.m.
Dr. Achim Mortzifer locks up his office in a residential neighborhood of Cologne. He's about to do something nearly unheard of in the United States, house calls. Almost all German general practitioners do them.
We visit 2 patients that I visit every 4 weeks and just have a look at them.
The patients he's visiting today depend on house calls. They're an elderly couple, Elspeth and Edwin Fedrovitz. They live in a small, crowded apartment on the 4th floor.
Guten Tag.
Mortsefer says Elspeth's got a never-ending list of problems. He's been seeing her for back pain, chronic anxiety, exhaustion from looking after her husband. Mortsefer says Edwin needs a lot of care. Both his legs were amputated 9 years ago because of blood vessel disease.
They tried to save the leg, but the operation was not successful, so they had to amputate.
There's no elevator. Edwin hasn't been out of the apartment for 4 years. Mortsefer's gone way beyond his role as a doctor to help them. He found Edwin and Elspeth a ground floor apartment that would have made life much easier. But they've lived in this apartment for 48 years, and they refuse to move.
Okay, good, fine.
Mortsefer checks Edwin's legs. He writes prescriptions for high blood pressure and gives Elspeth some pain medication.
Ich sag auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Alles Gute, in 3 Wochen.
He's frustrated. He can't do more for them.
Very difficult patients. They smoke. I still smoke. Both. And if I recommend some new treatment, they always say, no, we don't need that.
Mortsefer worries more about his patients than about his own income.
If you want to earn money, you have to choose another profession.
How much more did you get for these home visits?
Nearly 20 euros or something like that. Not very much.
That's $31. A German plumber gets more.
And because this is the end of the quarter, did you get anything for those?
I don't know. Difficult to say. No, maybe nothing.
But he doesn't dwell on that. Some doctors, he says, calculate how much is left in their quarterly budget every day.
The problem is, if you think about money a whole day, you will be unhappy. So that's an old rule of life, isn't it?
So we've heard two very different versions of how German doctors view their healthcare system, that it abuses doctors and that everything is okay. Who should we believe? To get a reality check, I pay a call on an old friend. I met Jürgen Inderschmitten 17 years ago when he was a medical student. Now he's a 42-year-old general practitioner in Meerbusch, a suburb of Düsseldorf.
That is Winnie the Pooh.
Jürgen's putting his 5-year-old son Kilian to bed.
Christopher Robin sagte, man könne nicht betreten heißen.
The Inderschmittens live in a modest 2-story row house. It cost around $400,000 2 years ago. Jürgen had to lay out another substantial sum to buy into a medical practice with two partners, so he has a lot of debt and no savings. He drives a second-hand 5-year-old Audi. He works long hours to bring in an income a little better than the average German GP. Over dinner, I asked him how things have changed for doctors since we first met.
The atmosphere, the feeling on the side of physicians and perhaps also patients, that things are getting worse. I think that's the most striking change, really.
He says something I've heard from other Germans, even people who aren't very sympathetic to doctors. Germans are worried about the future of health care. Already, Germany has a higher proportion of old people than America does.
The doctors argue, well, if the society is aging and if the society wants to have more expensive medicine, then it'll have to pay for it. And we are not the ones who will work more and more and more and don't see an income, increasing income for that.
He says Germany will have to spend more on health care in the coming years. But here's the thing, Germany can spend more, cover virtually everybody, and still not spend nearly as much as the United States. Richard Knox, NPR News.
If you want to compare medical costs, go to our website. You can find out how the average American medical bill stacks up against medical bills in Europe. You'll find that at npr.org/health.
Now to Afghanistan. Regret is a major theme in the best-selling novel and film about that country, The Kite Runner. It's also a major theme in the life of the Afghan boy who played the lead character. He is in hiding in Afghanistan because of threats from fellow Afghans who were offended by the movie because it includes rape. The movie is banned in Afghanistan, but nevertheless it's making the rounds on pirated DVDs. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson has been talking with the young actor and his family in Kabul.
In this scene from the Paramount Vantage movie, The Kite Runner, young Amir asks his houseboy, Hassan, to find the kite they've won in a kite-fighting contest. Don't come back empty-handed, Amir says. Hassan replies, for your sake, I'll come back with full hands. The request leads Hassan, who is from the country's Hazara minority, to an alley where he is raped by boys who are members of the Pashtun majority. Amir, who is also a Pashtun, witnesses the assault. Zakria Ibrahimi, who is 12, plays the young Amir in the movie. He calls him a coward for not helping Hassan. Many other Afghans who've seen the movie say it's not just Amir who did wrong. They accuse Paramount and the actors of creating a movie that insults their country. They say the movie, banned or not, will raise ethnic tensions that have already caused decades of war. Fear grew that the child actors might be harmed by insurgents or mobs, so Paramount relocated four of them, including Zakria. They were moved to Dubai last November, each with a guardian. Paramount put the boys in a private international school, rented them apartments, paid their families in Dubai and Kabul a monthly stipend, and searched for work for their guardians. Studio executives made the guardians sign contracts stating that if they talked to the media, the arrangements might change. Rich Klein, whose firm was hired by Paramount to help relocate the families, says the clause was meant to protect the boys' anonymity, not penalize them.
Studio has, I think, gone above and beyond to accept responsibility for the safety and the well-being of all of these boys, and has left their promises to these boys open-ended.
Zakria's aunt, Wahida Ibrahimi, feels otherwise. She says her roughly 4 months in Dubai were miserable, not just for her, but for her nephew, whom she's raised since infancy. She and Zakria feared he would be deported because his visa had expired. Paramount was working on getting him a new one. She says the small stipends and $400 a month job she was offered were not enough for her to support her family, even with their rent paid. So she and Zakria returned to Kabul in March. She says that's when the trouble began. Ibrahimi breaks down as she recalls yanking Zakria out of school here because Hazara classmates threatened to kill him. She says the family moved to a new neighborhood, but quickly left after a gang of men tried to force their way into the home. It turns out someone had distributed a dozen copies of the movie to her neighbors and told them where Zakria lived. They still live in Kabul, but Zakria spends all of his time indoors. He's pale and rarely smiles. His uncle, a shopkeeper, is homeschooling Zakria now. They are studying biology, the boy's favorite subject. He says he wishes he'd never done the movie, that he wants Paramount to get him and his family out of this mess. They want to go to America. Again, Rich Klein, whose firm works with Paramount.
I don't think anybody is happy with the fact that they left. Nobody, and now that Zakria is not doing well, there's very real concern.
But Klein says the family needs to be realistic about what Paramount can do for them. He hopes they'll consider moving back to Dubai. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.